Joe Biden was sworn in as President of the United States at 12 p.m. on January 20th, 2021. Just one day and 4 hours later, this happened.
Just filed articles of impeachment on President Joe Biden. We'll see how this goes.
We'll see how this goes. Biden had been president for less than 30 hours, but House conservatives decided that he had already committed high crimes and misdemeanors and needed to be removed from office. Since the very start of his administration, Republicans have been desperate to try and obscure and minimize the two impeachment trials of former President Donald Trump. And to do that, they aimed for Joe Biden to be the next American president to face the same humiliation. But that effort failed, and it failed in spectacular fashion. For 3 years, we have watched Republicans reach desperately for something, anything, that had even a hint of corruption they might pin on President Biden. But their efforts failed to turn up any convincing evidence that Biden or his family had engaged in corruption. Republicans did manage to wrangle one star witness who accused President Biden and his family of all sorts of wrongdoing. But it turned out that guy was just a dupe, passing along provably false information from people with ties to Russian intelligence. And he has since been arrested twice for lying to the FBI. Watching Republicans try to impeach Biden has been a lot like watching someone try to boil soup in a paper bag. Just a huge, embarrassing mess that accomplished nothing. And so Republicans then decided that they would try the next best thing. They would, if they could not impeach Joe Biden, they would impeach a member of Joe Biden's cabinet. And who better to be the victim than Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas?
Get rid of Mayorkas. He's derelict in his duty. This guy needs to go.
He deserves to lose his job simply because he has not followed the law.
Yeah, my view is, Sean, is that he needs to be impeached.
Secretary Mayorkas is in charge of the southern border. And Republicans wanted the southern border to be a key issue in this next election. So what could go wrong? Impeach him. Well, for starters, Republicans had the same problem that they always had. They didn't actually have any crimes to charge. Eventually, they settled on two made-up charges. The first was that Mayorkas failed to enforce the laws at the southern border, which simply wasn't true. In fact, under Secretary Mayorkas, there have been more deportations, returns, and expulsions than there were during the entire Trump administration. Republican's second charge was that Secretary Mayorkas had lied to Congress when he said that the border was under control, which is exactly what it sounds like, an argument about the semantics of what the word control means, and very clearly not a high crime or misdemeanor. So these were not real charges. But Republicans decided to move forward with them anyway. Yesterday, House Republicans brought their two sham impeachment articles to the Senate. And today, Senate Democrats killed both of them. After a few hours of procedural wrangling, a majority of senators voted that neither of the two articles of impeachment was a high crime or a misdemeanor, and therefore the articles were unconstitutional. And that was it. Here was Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell just after that vote.
Madam President, we've set a very unfortunate precedent here. This means that the Senate can ignore, in effect, the House's impeachment. This is a day that's not a proud day in the history of the Senate.
Republicans, including Mitch McConnell, are angry today because they spent the better part of this year on this impeachment, and for what? They could have spent that time actually trying to fix our immigration system. Democrats negotiated one of the strictest bipartisan border bills in decades, something that would have been unthinkable just a few years prior. It gave Republicans almost everything they wanted on border security. But Donald Trump forced Republicans to kill that bill because he thought it might help President Biden. So instead of legislation, Republicans made a failed attempt to impeach someone who committed no crime on an issue they themselves refused to solve. It would be one thing if this was the only area where our government is breaking down because of the hollowed out husk of what was once the Republican Party. But it is not. Because at the same time that all of this was happening in the Senate today, Republicans in the House of Representatives were also tripping all over themselves to benefit a strong man. Only this time, the strong man wasn't Donald Trump. Right now, Speaker Mike Johnson is facing a revolt from inside his own party over his decision to finally put aid to Ukraine up for a vote in the House. Johnson had resisted doing that for months, but this week he finally relented. Here he was explaining the reality of what he is facing just a few hours ago.
I'm operating with the smallest margin in U.S. history. I have a one vote margin. Listen, we're not going to get 100% of what we want right now because we have the smallest majority in history and we only have the majority in one chamber.
Despite what Speaker Johnson understands here, far-right members of his party are now saying they will call a vote to oust Johnson over his decision to bring up Ukraine aid. And that's going to go to the floor for a vote. That is how much the far right does not want to help Ukraine combat Russia's war of aggression. And this is not just a problem for the Republican Party. It is a problem for Ukraine and America and the rest of the world. Because Ukraine and the vote on Ukraine funding has become a leverage point for Russia. The Washington Post has some explosive reporting today on newly revealed documents from inside Vladimir Putin's government. Documents which show how Russia is seeking to subvert Western support for Ukraine and disrupt the domestic politics of the United States and European countries through propaganda campaigns and supporting isolationist and extremist policies. Russia is fomenting division over Ukraine because it wants to weaken America's role in the world. In particular, one Russian policy expert cited in one of these documents specifically calls on Russia to continue to facilitate the coming to power of isolationist right-wing forces in America. Just to put a finer point on this, Russia very much wants the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world to continue doing exactly what they're doing because it serves Russia's interests. This is not the only piece of evidence we have of that. Last week, two top House Republicans warned that pro-Russian propaganda had infiltrated the Republican Party and was being repeated by Republican members of Congress in debates about Ukraine. Earlier this week, Marjorie Taylor Greene parroted Vladimir Putin's central lie, justifying his invasion of Ukraine by calling the Ukrainian government Nazis. Ukraine, for the record, is the only nation in the world other than Israel to have a Jewish head of state, Volodymyr Zelensky. But Marjorie Taylor Greene wants to block aid to that country because she says it is run by Nazis. So who knows where this vote on Ukraine aid could lead? Republicans could vote to remove Speaker Johnson and once again throw the House of Representatives and therefore much of our American government again into chaos, something that would directly serve Russia's ends. And maybe that is the whole point. Joining me now is Senator Chris Murphy, Democrat from Connecticut. He is a member of the Senate Appropriations Committee and the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Senator Murphy, it's great to see you. Thank you so much for being here. First, let me just get your reaction to the reporting we have out of the Post about the way in which Russia is delighted to see the infighting over Ukraine aid unfolding in the U.S. Congress.
Well, of course they are, because the only way that they can win in Ukraine is if the United States withdraws its support for Ukraine. And you know, let's be clear about why we care so much about stopping Russia from taking over Ukraine. It's not just because we have a sympathy and a kinship for the Ukrainian people. It's because Putin has made clear that he's not going to stop at Ukraine. And if he is given the entire country, very quickly, he could be moving on to a NATO ally. That will be U.S. troops. That'll be U.S. Men and women, Americans, fighting and dying in Europe. That'll be a green light to China to invade Taiwan, potentially erupting a regional war in Southeast Asia. This is cataclysmic for U.S. interests. The triggers that could be set off by Putin winning so expeditiously in Ukraine only because the United States abandons them there. So there is no doubt that Putin is spending a lot of money here in the United States and in Europe trying to undermine support for Ukraine, trying to support individuals who are trying to argue against Ukraine funding. And listen, there's no doubt that he is rooting very badly for Donald Trump. There's no doubt that he will likely play a big role in this upcoming election, because if we get this bill across the finish line, Alex, if we do fund Ukraine, it'll only be through the beginning of next year. And if Donald Trump is elected, that's a pretty clear guarantee that this would be the last Ukraine funding bill that would ever clear the House, Senate, and get passed and signed into law by the president.
To that end, I just want to draw everyone's attention to a quote from Mikhail Khodorkovsky, who's a Russian opposition figure. And he says, the Americans consider that insofar as they are not directly participating in the war in Ukraine, then any loss is not their loss. This is an absolute misunderstanding. A defeat for Ukraine, he said, means that many will stop fearing challenging the U.S. and the costs for the United States will only increase. It feels like some people in the Senate, in the Republican Party, understand the importance here of not empowering the isolationists, both as a matter of sort of Republican functionality and also in terms of the cause of Western-style liberal democracy around the world. Do you think the fact that Speaker Johnson is willing to bring up this Ukraine aid funding to the chagrin of the far-right members of his caucus is a signal that House Republicans are finally beginning to realize that they've been employed as useful idiots for the Kremlin?
No, I would not go that far. It seems as if Speaker Johnson has made an individual decision that it would be a disaster for the United States to abandon Ukraine. And I think he knows that this would be his legacy, right? His political obituary would lead with his abandonment of Ukraine, because he has a coalition of Democrats and Republicans that support Ukraine. The Senate has already voted 70-30 with a big bipartisan majority for Ukraine. So he knows it would be him and him only that would get the blame for handing Ukraine to Vladimir Putin. So I don't think this suggests any conversion inside the Republican Party to understand the way they've been influenced by Russia. I think it's Speaker Johnson making the right decision in the here and now. And for today, at least, we should celebrate that.
Do you have an expectation that we're going to be looking for a new Speaker of the House? And if we are, what's your expectation for the U.S. Congress and what happens next?
So, you know, my sense is that there are some Democrats who will oppose a motion to vacate in the House of Representatives should Speaker Johnson go through with his proposal to bring aid to Ukraine, aid to Israel, and humanitarian assistance before the House. And should that be successful, he needs to get enough Republicans to support it so that alongside Democrats, it passes the House and moves to the Senate. So it's possible that he will survive a motion to vacate because there will be a handful of Democrats who will support him. And the reality is right now the only way to pass anything through the House of Representatives is a coalition of mostly Democrats, because the majority of Republicans in the House are just full-time arsonists. They are inside government, to destroy the legitimacy of government, to try to burn down the government. And so, you know, whether it's votes who's the next speaker, whether it's votes to pass Ukraine aid, votes to pass a budget, it's really still Democrats that are the only thing that keep that place functional. And Johnson has finally realized that.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of burning down the government, I have to ask you about what happened in your chamber today. Democrats effectively killed off the impeachment trial. Senator Mitch McConnell, who likes to be an institutionalist when it suits him, suggested that an unfortunate precedent had been set in so doing, that the Senate effectively is ignoring the will of the House. What's your reaction to that?
Well, the dangerous precedent that we could have set was to legitimize and endorse this sham impeachment process. I mean, those articles of impeachment are laughable on their face. There is not a sliver, there's not a hint of a high crime or misdemeanor. This is just 40 pages of complaints about what's happening at the border today. What it really stands for is a pretty simple premise. Republicans do not want to fix the border, right? As you mentioned in your opening, they had a chance to do that. I negotiated the toughest set of changes in border law in 40 years that would have brought order to the southwest border. Republicans rejected that bill because they actually want the border to be out of control. What they want is for there to be headlines every day about how chaotic the border is so that they can score political points and so that it will help them in this election. That's what the articles of impeachment are, just a mechanism to keep the conversation about the border in the headlines. And I think the American people are catching on. I think all of this evidence that Republicans are just interested in politics and are allergic when given the chance to actually vote for changes that would get the border under control is starting slowly to sink in with the public.
Yeah, I mean, they're definitely keeping the border in the headlines through their own political chicanery. Good job. Senator Chris Murphy, thanks so much for making the time tonight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
We have lots more ahead tonight, including Republicans wasting no time to turn a congressional hearing on anti-Semitism on college campuses into a broadside against wokeism. But first, day three of jury selection resumes tomorrow morning in the criminal hush money trial of Donald Trump. George Conway was in the courthouse this week, and he joins me right here after the break.
MSNBC is going to be live here all night.
Today's news requires more facts.
Palestinians and Israelis are blaming each other for the tragedy that has inflamed the region.
More analysis.
Most of the states with the worst rates of gun deaths are ones where Republicans control the state government.
And more perspective.
This is not just about women and pregnant people in Texas. This is about people across this country.
The world's never been harder to understand. That's why it's never been more important to try. MSNBC. Understand more.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Donald Trump was not in court today, but his criminal hush money trial was clearly top of mind this morning. He took to Truth Social to rant about what he considered unfairness during jury selection yesterday, specifically that his lawyers were not allowed unlimited opportunities to strike prospective jurors. Never mind the fact that Trump's legal team was allotted the same number of so-called peremptory challenges as prosecutors, and they've used the same number of those challenges to weed out people they believe would not be impartial jurors. It appears what Donald Trump is actually upset about is that he is being treated, so far, mostly like any other criminal defendant. Trump has had to sit through the Groundhog Day-like tedium of jury selection and its repetitive questions. And after Trump spoke and gestured in the direction of a juror, he was reprimanded, as any other defendant would be, by Judge Juan Merchan, who said he would not have jurors intimidated in his courtroom. This process is proceeding so normally that Judge Merchan believes that a jury will be seated in time for opening statements to begin on Monday, which is way ahead of the two-week timeline he estimated earlier this week. Joining me now is George Conway, an attorney and contributor to The Atlantic. George, thank you for being here. I know you were in the vicinity, you were in the zone, and I want to hear about what that was like. But first, what do you make of the dissonance between Trump asserting that this is all such an unfair jury selection process and the fact that seven jurors have already been selected?
Well, I mean, he's going to say everything is unfair no matter how it comes out. And, he thinks he's going to get unlimited peremptory challenges. I mean, that's just classic.
That doesn't happen.
It does not happen. I mean, if it did happen, then, you know, this trial could take forever. I mean, we're going to strike everybody in Manhattan. I mean, it's crazy.
And yes.
When you think about it, yeah, he would happy to do that. It would take the entire year and next year and the year after that. But he'd have to sit there. But that's classic Donald Trump. Donald Trump thinks the rules don't apply to him, and if they do apply to him, then it's unfair. And that's his whole shtick.
I mean, so far it really feels like, and you wrote to this in The Atlantic, that this is kind of proceeding apace in an almost humdrum fashion, with the exception of these outbursts. And I do have to ask you about this because Judge Merchan has not been playing around with this gag order, right? And we know that I think it was a few hours ago Trump reposted on Truth Social this claim from Jesse Waters of Fox. They are catching undercover liberal activists lying to the judge in order to get on the Trump jury, so saith Jesse Waters. Does that run up to the line of violating the gag order? Does that flirt with it, or is that fair game.
It's not fair game because it's a lie. I mean, there's no evidence to support it. And if he were referring to specific individuals and trying to intimidate them, it would violate the gag order. I just think he's just trying to poison the well in the public domain to say that nothing here is fair. It can't be fair. People in Manhattan can't be fair to me, even though he spent his entire, you know, he spent his entire life in New York until relatively recently.
Well, independent of just trying to poison the well, which is no small thing, it right. also could be, I mean, at some point could be construed as this goes on and the jury yeah. is finally selected as a form of intimidation that puts the jurors' lives in danger if they're perceived to be liberal stooges out there to get Trump.
Yeah.
My question to you is, does Mershon, I mean, he has uttered, I believe, at some point that the suggestion that jail time could be a part of this if Trump violates the gag order. Do you think there is any universe in which that happens?
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think it's possible because I think he does not know boundaries, and boundaries have to be explained to him, and he has to actually believe that the boundaries are going to be applied to him. And I think before that happens, I think Mershon's going to be very, very explicit yeah. about it. It's like, okay, that's it. You've done this. This is it. Next time, bring your toothbrush.
Wow. I mean, you've seen Mershon in action. Do you feel like that is going to take an extraordinary amount of fortitude to even consider doing something like that to a former president of the United States who is a current candidate for president? I mean, what is the impression you've gotten of the judge?
He's a judge's judge. He's a very straight, businesslike, very straightforward and serious jurist. I think he's very competent. I think he's very, very conscious of what he's doing and what he's projecting in the courtroom. I think he's going to protect the jurors because that's the most important thing. His job is to ensure a fair trial, and that means protecting the people who are going to be deciding the facts of the case, which is the members of the jury, members of the public.
When you talk about Trump's inability to control himself, there is something happening, I believe, tomorrow afternoon called a Sandoval hearing. My law degree at television law school is I'm getting closer to taking the bar. But a Sandoval hearing is going to determine basically which of Trump's misconduct and criminal acts could be used if Trump were to take the witness stand and were to undergo cross-examination. Is that right?
That's basically it, yes.
So Trump's going to be presented with a litany of wrongdoing.
Right.
And is that, like, can you explain that process and what the likelihood is that Trump absolutely freaks out during it?
He's not going to enjoy it because he's going to hear about all the things that all the bad things that have been attributed to him. And I don't know how he's going to react, but it's going to be everything from all the things that he's done to lie in the public domain, including about E. Jean Carroll,
yeah.
all that stuff. I mean, if he goes on the stand, he's going to open a lot of that up. And I think the issue is whether or not it's sufficiently probative of his credibility for the prosecution to cross examine him on it. And it probably will be. So he's not somebody who should go up
on the witness stand.
That being said, he's a narcissistic sociopath. He's impulsive, and if he feels on a given day that he has to do it, and he could decide to do it and overrule his lawyers. But at other times he's followed his lawyer's advice. I mean, he followed his lawyer's advice during the first E. Jean Carroll trial, basically not to show up.
Right.
And then he showed up for the second one, and then he couldn't contain himself in front of the jury. That cost him tens of millions of dollars because he basically behaved exactly as the plaintiff was describing him, as somebody with remorseless, who was ready to say anything, who had contempt for the court's rulings and contempt for the truth. And he acted out right in front of the jury. And it's going to be a lot harder for him this time because this is a lot more. If this is about his own people are going to be testifying and describing things
right.
that he did, people who were loyal to him from David Pecker. We've never actually heard from David Pecker. Hope Hicks. We've never really heard from her about this. And he's going to have to sit there and listen to it. He's not going to enjoy himself, and you can't guarantee that he'll be able to control himself.
Yeah, I mean, he's going to have to listen to it day in and day out. He has to be there for all of this. Right. He gets a break on Wednesdays. He is going to be accosted with a lot of material, a lot of tedium.
Yeah.
And, you know, what does that do to a man who, as you call it, is a psychopathic narcissist?
He's a narcissistic sociopath.
Sorry. I mean,
you know, he's a psychopath also.
Tomato. What has it been like? I mean, as you have watched this proceeding unfold, you described the place in the building in which it is unfolding as kind of a beehive of activity, and yet it's also incredibly mundane, right?
Right. It's a standard issue office building built during the Work Projects Administration, 1938 to 1941. It is, as one pool reporter put it, drab. It's plain. It's ordinary. It's Spartan. And it's very functional. And it's not, you know, there are no gold-plated toilets. There's nothing fancy about it. I mean, it's sort of, it's very not Trump-like.
Yeah.
And it's not an environment that he would want to be associated with, even if it were something he wouldn't want to own it.
Right.
So it's just the juxtaposition of him and his unwillingness to accede to the rules and norms of society and his just contempt for the legal process is lined up against this building and institution mm-hmm. that does this every day
yeah.
to hundreds with hundreds of people involved. And it was just the juxtaposition, as I wrote in today, of the ordinary and the extraordinary was just quite amazing. And the fact that it was kind of mundane to the point where even I kind of nodded off on day one is just, it was a tribute to the system, actually.
Yeah. Well, you're allowed to nod off because you're not running a presidential campaign where your chief line of attack is calling someone sleepy, right?
That's true.
There's that rub.
Sleepy George.
George, I look forward to more dispatches from the front lines. Thanks for joining me on set tonight. Coming up, Republican lawmakers in Arizona today once again blocked an attempt to repeal a 160-year-old abortion law set to go into effect in their state. Erin Carmon joins me to discuss that. But first, House Republicans held a hearing on anti-Semitism at Columbia University today, or at least that was supposed to be the topic. More on that coming up next.
It's Monday, everyone. We're happy to have you here on this Monday night. Lots of news to get to tonight.
Make more of your Mondays on MSNBC with Jen Psaki and Rachel Maddow back to back.
If you were talking to a voter, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
Was this the kind of proceeding you would expect in a typical New York DA's case, or does this really feel different?
Inside with Jen Psaki at 8 p.m. Eastern, followed by The Rachel Maddow Show at 9, Mondays on MSNBC. Monday night.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts, former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
In case you missed it, this is how most of today was spent in the House Education Committee hearing on anti-Semitism at Columbia University.
I didn't get to fit.
Your answer.
No.
let me move on here.
Republicans in Congress brought Columbia University President Manoush Shafiq down to Washington, less to hear her answers and more to pointedly say questions at her. Now, if the Republicans in the committee were actually listening, President Shafiq was quite clear. Here was her response to a question about whether anti-Semitic speech is tolerated at Columbia.
It's abhorrent and has no place in our community. I think one of the issues that we are actively debating now, and which David Schizer, I hope, as part of the anti-Semitism task force, will help us find solutions, as you've asked for, Congresswoman, is to actually clarify where language crosses the line from protected speech to discriminatory or harassing speech.
President Shafiq was very precise there. The debate that should be happening on college campuses right now is the one about where the line is between First Amendment speech and discriminatory speech. That is a very worthwhile conversation. But that is not the conversation we saw in the House today. Instead, we saw stuff like this.
How many, do you just in your own mind, could you rattle off like 10 Republicanish faculty out of your 4,000 off the top of your head?
Yeah, I could actually, but we have two of our fellows from our Institute for Global Politics who are former Trump administration officials.
Let me give you another question.
What does a number of Republicans on the faculty at Columbia have to do with anti-Semitism? We're going to get to that. The congressman asking the question there clearly did not like that President Shafiq could answer his question. It didn't fit the narrative that he was trying to establish. A narrative other Republicans tried to cement with questions like these.
Can you explain why the word folks is spelled F-O-L-X throughout this guidebook and in other places at the School of Social Work? Is this how Columbia University spells the word folks?
No.
What does a student group spelling the word folks with an X to be gender inclusive? What does that have to do with anti-Semitism? Well, both that question and the one asking President Shafiq how many Republicans are on the Columbia faculty, both of those questions have a lot to do with the conversation Republicans were actually trying to have in the House today. A week ago, a group of Jewish faculty members at Columbia published this open letter to President Shafiq, imploring her not to fall for the exact Republican campaign we saw in that committee hearing room today. Rather than being concerned with the safety and well-being of Jewish students on campuses, the committee is leveraging anti-Semitism in a wider effort to caricature and demonize universities as hotbeds of woke indoctrination. We are going to talk with the dean of the Columbia School of Journalism, Jelani Cobb, about what is actually happening on Columbia's campus and what Republicans are really trying to do here, right after the break. In December, Republicans on the House Education Committee questioned the presidents of Harvard, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania about anti-Semitism. Days later, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, Elizabeth McGill, resigned. And then, after enduring a month of additional personal and professional attacks, the president of Harvard, Claudine Gay, also resigned. And now, today, it was the president of Columbia University, Manoush Shafiq, who Republicans had in the hot seat. Joining me now to help unpack what is actually happening on Columbia's campus and what these hearings are really about is Jelani Cobb, dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism. Dean Cobb, it is great to see you. I know it has been a busy time on campus. Can you give me a sense of what is happening on your campus? There was a hearing today where I feel like we didn't actually really get an accurate picture of how deep the battle lines run and what the fundamental arguments are about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's contested. You know, there are, debates. There are heated debates happening. There are protests and demonstrations and counter-protests and counter-demonstrations. Just as this has become, a hugely polarizing issue in lots of different avenues of American life, you know, we're seeing that play out on a university campus where people are supposed to engage with ideas, they're supposed to debate, they're supposed to think about these things critically and so on. So we are seeing a lot of that happening. And in addition, on the day-to-day, people are going to class, learning, reading, preparing to graduate, and all the other things that happen in a normal academic year.
Is there a conversation about, President Shafiq got at this in the hearing today, that the conversation needs to be about what is free speech and what is discriminatory speech? Is that a debate that is happening to any end at this point at the Columbia campus?
The irony of this, and this is a debate that we've we've had serially, you know, long before this conflict began. This was a debate and a robust issue that we should be debating on college campuses. Now, of course, the irony of this is that, you know, the president was being questioned by Congress, which actually has purview over this. It makes legislation and laws. And, you know, the Supreme Court, which determines, you know, by precedence, what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. And so really, universities are being beaten up, you know, and in Columbia in particular, being beaten up over things that we have really no control over. We're following the guidance of the people who are actually doing the questioning there.
Well, it seems like to that end, what was happening in Congress today wasn't really about Columbia. It wasn't necessarily about anti-Semitism. It seemed like it was very clearly an opportunity for Republicans to go after what they perceive to be a group of liberal elites and the wokeism that has penetrated America's college campus system. Did you think that they were successful in maligning Columbia University today?
I mean, they've said all kinds of things about Columbia University.
Yeah.
And that's not the institution that I think, you know, most of us experience. Even though, you know, there have been incidents of anti-Semitism, no question. And those incidents have been denounced, you know, broadly by that community. But what we've seen in place of this has been a kind of disingenuous caricature of what the university is, what the university stands for, who our students are, who our faculty are, you know, what's going on. And that's been, you know, not simply, you know, today, that's been going on for weeks before this. And so, you know, listening to that hearing, you would not think that there was anything redeemable, you know, happening at Columbia University.
Do you think, I mean, it seems that the war in Gaza and the absolute schism that has been created in its aftermath, and some would say predating the war in Gaza, has been a political opportunity for Republicans and conservatives in particular to kind of get at the culture of wokeism and the culture of liberal elites. Like, not to be repetitive, but I do wonder how effective they have been in turning some part of the country against what is perceived as, you know, higher institutions.
Sure. But I think that one of the, like, more pernicious things and one of the more disingenuous things here is the presentation of this as if this were a kind of matter of principle.
Mm-hmm.
What this is really about is the perception that universities are too liberal, especially elite institutions are too liberal. So this is, you know, is on par with the attacks on DEI. It's on par with the attacks on affirmative action. It's, you know, kind of following the playbook of what we've seen happen at New College in Florida, for instance. So the idea is supposed to be that we're that laying the ground for these institutions to be something other than what they are perceived to be. Now, these are also heterogeneous institutions.
Yeah.
I teach opinion writing. I have students whose views are all across the spectrum, as you will find at this university, at the institution. And so
Republicans attend Columbia, too, in other words.
Shockingly enough, they do, actually.
They do.
Yeah, and I've actually taught a few, amazingly. But that's not what, you know, none of these issues of substance were on display there. This was a kind of theater in order to caricature the university, to further an agenda of kind of making it more difficult for our institutions to function in the way that they have.
Yeah, I will say, if we have time, I would love to play an exchange between President Shafiq and Representative Rick Allen, who was asking if she wanted Columbia to be cursed by God. Can we play that?
Are you familiar with Genesis 12:3? If you bless Israel, I will bless you. If you curse Israel, I will curse you. Do you consider that a serious issue? I mean, do you want Columbia University to be cursed by God of the Bible?
Definitely not.
Okay. Well, that's good.
It's like a very curious logic to somehow bring in white Christian nationalism in a conversation that's supposed to be about anti-Semitism. I'm not going to get into the circuitous logic by which Representative Allen got there, but it does betray the sort of underpinnings of this argument, right? It is a culture war. It is about Republican, white Christian national conservatism against heterogeneous, like multicultural liberal learning. And that is the fight that they want to have.
Yeah, I also thought it was race baiting the president who was of Egyptian origin. I think asking if you're familiar with Genesis was a kind of dig in that direction. And so it was thinly veiled. Like, what was happening here was the most thinly veiled of the most pernicious parts of what we've seen, you know, particularly given, you know, the proliferation of anti-Semitism that we have seen in the right wing of that party itself.
Right.
So
maybe the mirror should be turned upon the party in the line of questioning. I have to ask you, you know, we talk about this as a kind of an exercise in politics, but it has had some real consequences. The number of university heads who have had to step down that have, you know, had to leave their posts or have been otherwise, you know, seriously professionally wounded in the course of this. Does that make you worry? Do you think we're turning a corner when the sort of, you know, the goals of at least one side in this have been revealed to be not potentially that pure?
So I think the real concern is that when we're in a moment of democratic crisis, you know, and this goes back to the 1950s when we're talking about the Cold War, how do you handle challenges to your democracy? The way that you handle challenges to your democracy is by being more democratic. You have to double and triple down on your principles. And so to see these kind of assaults on free speech and on academic freedom at a point where we are also seeing other parts of our democratic tradition being assailed is chilling, is deeply chilling.
Dean of the Columbia University School of Journalism, Jelani Cobb, thank you for bringing much needed perspective to us on a night like this. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Your time.
Thank you.
Still to come tonight, Arizona Democrats fight to repeal a Civil War era law criminalizing most abortions while Republicans do everything they can to stop Democrats. We'll talk about the strategy and the political fallout with Erin Carmone coming up next.
There are so many people who are watching right now and watching what Arizona is doing.
Members, we have had since 1864 to repeal this abhorrent law. And for the past 6 years, Democrats have introduced this bill. Democrats have introduced this bill for 6 years and been ignored, every single one of them, including this one.
That was the Arizona House floor today after Republican state legislators, for the second time in less than 2 weeks, rejected Democrats' efforts to repeal an abortion ban from 1864, which was reinstated last week by Arizona's top court. Joining me now is Erin Carmone, senior correspondent at New York Magazine and author of an upcoming book about the post-Dobbs era called Unbearable, Being Pregnant in America. Erin, what do you make of the discrepancy between what national Republicans are calling for in terms of getting rid of this ban and what the Republicans in Arizona are actually doing?
Well, I mean, what happened is that the Supreme Court handed them a gift that has actually proven to be a curse for Republicans. Republicans, some of them are true believers, such as the Speaker of the Arizona State House, who says some of us believe that killing children is wrong or that abortion is killing children, and people like Donald Trump, who will say whatever it takes for them to win. Now, I think up until the Supreme Court made it possible for these zombie laws to go into effect, these two sides could be in alliance. They could be in coalition. Unfortunately for them, Americans have actually seen the true real life consequences of abortion being banned when it's not just a debate tactic or a political move. And they found out that they really, really don't like the reality of how women are being treated across the country. So hence this conflict where people like Carrie Lake and Donald Trump would like to say that they're against something that they, in fact, either championed or, in the case of Donald Trump, directly enabled. Suddenly, they're acting shocked. Why? They're in tough races. Contrast that with the legislators in Arizona. The House and the Senate are both controlled by Republicans. There were, I believe, one in each chamber crossover votes. When the motion to repeal or the motion to begin debate on the repeal failed, when it was blocked by Republicans, they cheered. So on the one hand, you have Carrie Lake working the phones and Trump saying this goes too far. But when push comes to shove, there are plenty of Republicans who are thrilled that the 19th century is coming back to rule the women of Arizona.
I mean, if Republicans won't do it and Democrats can't do it, it feels like the voters of Arizona will do it. We now know that Republicans are concerned that a ballot referendum might enshrine the right to an abortion in the Arizona state constitution, therefore overriding the ban. And there seems to be some chicanery afoot. Arizona Republicans want to add a second referendum to the ballot to confuse things. And I wonder if you think they could be successful in that or whether Arizonans are paying close enough attention here that it won't work?
You know, I was on the phone today with the spokeswoman for that campaign, and she at least does not believe that Arizonans will be fooled. I mean, we are seeing this sustained voter outrage and interest and seeing past the kinds of obfuscation that Republicans are putting forward. Remember what happened in Ohio where they tried to change the rules on referenda. Voters didn't fall for that, even though abortion wasn't directly at issue, and then went on to pass that overwhelmingly. I think what you're hearing in Arizona is people kind of scrambling. Notice, you know, that what the Republicans are offering to put on the ballot or all of the legislation that they're offering directly relies on trying to confuse people. And to be clear, some of that confusion is actually harming patients because all of these kind of dueling laws and which one is in effect have actually prevented people from getting abortions in Arizona, even when it's legal and allowed. So it has real life consequences. But the politics of it, I think there's no reason to think that Arizona is going to be tremendously different from many of these even red states where when the democratic process that the Supreme Court said that it wanted to allow in Dobbs actually happens, voters are going to say, actually, we want abortion to be legal, we want it to be safe, and we want it to be accessible.
Erin Carmon, thank you for your great reporting on this. Really appreciate your time tonight.
Thank you.
That is our show for tonight.